on Radio Free Brooklyn.
Hi, everybody. You're listening to Into the Dark here on Radio Free Brooklyn. If you like the kind of stuff you're hearing on this station, you should consider throwing us a few dollars at radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. We'll see you guys on the other end of the theme music. Stay tuned for more Into the Dark.
Skeptic among believers, and the believer among skeptics.
Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Who are the witches?
Magic, necromancy, and witchcraft.
Wake up! They're all about you! All around you!
They're not always
the often erotic world of the witch.
The journalist with an inside knowledge of witchcraft.
It's a sex thing deep down, of course.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Into the Dark, the show that takes you to every wishy where and when you've ever wondered about. We got a great show today, so we're going to do an interview with someone who's written a fair amount on the subject of brujas, which are a tradition of witchcraft coming out of Mexico, or at least practiced widely in Mexico. And we're going to be talking to them on the phone. And so, followers of the show might be aware of my history of attempting to use the in-studio phone. There have been successes. There have been trials. But I'm feeling confident that this isn't going to go terribly. It might just be, you know, kind of a... We're going to try. I believe in us. So let's give it a shot. Hey, can you hear me?
Yes. How's my voice? Is it okay?
It's great. Okay, cool. So thank you for coming on the show. Is it Lucina or is it Lucina?
Lucina.
Okay, so Lucina Stone is the author of, just for everybody else, hey, welcome to the show. So Lucina Stone is the author of Santa Muerta, which is from 2016, and is the winner of two Latino Book Awards, one for Best Sci-Fi Novel and one for Best New Author, and has also been published elsewhere in little bits and pieces. Hey, how are you?
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on. It's delightful.
Ah, well, thanks for coming on. So I first came across your work with an essay you did for Luna Magazine, which we are going to link to when this becomes a podcast, talking about an incident when you were younger where your mother was doing a particular kind of magical rite with apples.
Mm-hmm.
And could you just sort of explain what that rite was, what the intention of that whole thing was for everybody?
Yes. So my mom, this was a cultural belief of hers, that having apples in the house would draw negative energy away and would also bring abundance. So she kept apples at her altar, and she would change out the apples. At first, when she first started to use them, she would clear the apples out weekly, and then she would also... as time went on, you know, she would check them to see when they needed to be changed. And as a teenager seeing this, it was hard for me to understand what she was doing and why. Because none of my friends, nobody's family, nobody that I knew did that in their home. So I wrote the essay based on my experience with how I came to, you know, understand it. Because when, as a teenager, you think of magic, you think of these big gestures and you know, what you see on movies. But the simplicity of the apple was really very much opened my eyes to possibilities.
So you were growing up at the time in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And your mother had brought these traditions, I think, from Mexico, is my understanding. Was this a family thing that had been passed down? Was this sort of her? Was this mostly her, or was this something that she, like, you know, her mother had done, and so on?
It was passed down to my mom from her sister in Mexico. After a visit, she had shown her how she was using the apples in her home. And I was very little at the time, but my mom, when she came here, brought the tradition with her.
Okay. And this apple, I mean, was there a lot of sort of magical stuff going on in the house at the time, or was it sort of centralized to this?
You know, there was always weird things going on. You know, my mom has always been very intuitive and sensitive. So my mom would always have dreams and talk about her dreams and things that, you know, she would have like precognitive dreams a lot of the time. And so she would share them with us. So we always knew that there was something a little strange about my mom, you know, a little mysterious. And, you know, her beliefs in, she wasn't able to participate in regular Catholic masses and things like that at the time because my mom had come out as gay. So she didn't feel that there was a place for her at church. And so she made her own altar and made her own, found her own sense of spirituality.
Okay. So did you get the sense that she was sort of incorporating these sort of magical acts into her sort of larger Catholic belief structure, or was it, or Christian belief structure, or was it that this was sort of instead of, like, was this sort of like part of a larger alternative that she was sort of doing outside of the larger organized church, or is this like in addition to?
Yeah.
Is that question, does that make sense as a question? Because I feel like I'm getting a bit.
It does. You know, it was her own way of integrating, you know, what she had learned through Catholicism and integrating it into her life now. So that was her way of combining the two.
All right. And so at the time, it sounds like you were fairly skeptical of all this as a child.
Yeah, of course. You know, because, again, I would imagine magic to be, like, big. You know, something like extraordinary lights, flashing, either something bigger than just these apples.
Okay. And like, as you grew older, did you, I mean, you clearly developed a much more complex relationship with your mother's spiritual practices, but did you ever sort of come to partake in them yourself to some extent?
Yeah, you know, for me, I started to also keep an altar, but it's for me a little bit different. Mine I keep at work where I do counseling. And so, you know, I've set it up in a way that it's comfortable for, you know, my clients who come in and they see this, they think it's an altar, but they're not sure. So I've made it in a way that is integrated in my life the way that my mom did for her. So it's, I do use an altar at work and I do have one in my home. And it is, you know, a place of peace, a place of, you know, reconnecting and a place for meditation for me.
Okay. So I've been getting a fair number of questions about altars and about the idea of having an altar, keeping an altar, making an altar. And I know there are a number of different traditions, but if there were people out there listening to this right now who are interested in using an altar as part of creating a space in their home or where they work or somewhere else, is there any advice or possible guidelines you might give them for how to sort of go about starting from scratch with a thing like that?
Well, it depends on their religious belief. You know, I think that if they want to integrate their religious, you know, for me, I do keep a small picture of the Virgin of Guadalupe. For me, that helps me to center. So I do keep a picture. Also, candles are important. I think a quartz crystal, amethyst, things like that really help to center your energy are really important to have in, you know, with your altar.
Okay. It's interesting that you bring up amethyst, because I think somewhere in your... I've been reading a lot of your stuff in the course of a short period of time, so like it's kind of hard for me to remember what came from where. But I think you mentioned bringing... having amethyst with you as a child at some point as sort of a protective element.
Yes.
Were there other...
Yes.
Sort of... because, I mean, like, the altar... The thing about, like, an altar is, like, it's sort of a centralized space. Like, you sort of put it somewhere, and it's there for you to go to when you need to. But is there anything else, like, in that, like, in the sort of category of magic you would bring with you on a daily basis? Like, magic that would sort of come with you on your day?
Yes, absolutely. I always keep with me... I always wear an amethyst necklace. My grandfather was a miner. He would mine the amethyst. And he, for our family, was an important, super important, because he would bring home stones. And from those stones, they gave each of their daughters a necklace with amethyst. And it was for protection. And so that was passed on through the tradition in my family. So definitely, I always have amethyst on me. And recently, I started learning more about crystals and pendulums, and so expanding my own awareness into what else and how else to use crystals. So I always keep some crystals with me. So that's always, it's definitely an important part. And I also wanted to say that I think an altar, yes, it is a place where you go to, but I really feel that it's important to integrate it, you know, in a central place where you're always kind of seeing it, kind of integrating it more into your life.
Okay, so like... So you wouldn't see an altar as like a separate space. It's more sort of like a presence in the home or in the workplace.
Yes.
Okay.
For me, it is. Yes. For me, it is.
So in terms of, I'm curious about, just going back for a second, about the shift that you went through in terms of your relationship with your mother's spiritual practices. Because you start off being skeptical, you know, saying that, like, magic should be more sort of dramatic, have more sort of biff and pow to it. And then kind of coming back around, would you say, like what, how did that shift happen? Like, was it sudden? Was it sort of a slow over time kind of thing?
Well, you know, it was an incident that happened with my mom's altar, which I wrote about in the essay, where, you know, for the first time, she had asked me to set the apples for her because she was kind of rushing around waiting for company to come. And these were brand new, fresh apples. So I put them out in the way that I had seen her do it many times before. And, you know, when we received our guests and after they left, my mom called me to come and check the apples, and they had all rotted. So that incident really helped me to understand that there's a lot more going on, that there's a lot more, that just because I'm not seeing it in that big, explosive way doesn't mean that things aren't happening. That so it brought me a deeper sense of energy.
Okay, that's fantastic.
And understanding energy.
That's wonderful. And did you... From then on, like, was this a shared practice with your mother after a while? Like, did it bring you closer together to have this between you?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. It brought us much closer together. And it also helped her to open up more about her stories and her experiences and, you know, all the different things that she had felt, you know, paranormal stuff and things that had happened to her in her life. So, you know, the more that we were able to connect, the more stories she shared. And so that's where a lot of the stories from the book, Santa Muerte, come from, or from a lot of her experiences.
Okay. So that's interesting. One does sort of get the sense that the book is heavily inspired by these traditions and these sorts of things. But, I'm curious as to, when you first started writing it, what was sort of, did you find yourself just sort of naturally falling into these traditions as sort of interesting things to consider and talk about? Or was it did you sort of start with a project saying, I want to write about these things and put them into this context?
It was a combination of, you know, the dream, the book came to me in dreams. and it came to me in bits and pieces. So, you know, I started to draw some of those pieces together and incorporate the folklore and tie the story together based on all those pieces. So it's definitely a strange combination.
I mean, and certainly a successful one, I would argue. So in terms of well, you've got these traditions that you're learning from your mother, you're working with her on these, and then you start to sort of expand into crystals, into pendulums.
Mm-hmm.
And do you feel like what got you into, I can sort of see the connection between sort of like the amethyst, and then you sort of move on to more crystals, more stones of that sort. But like with the pendulums, like where does this come from? Where are you just constantly exploring? Like what, or does something sort of?
I'm definitely constantly exploring. I just finished doing my Reiki 2 level training, and starting Reiki 3. So, which was a really powerful experience for me. Learning about Reiki and also being able to give Reiki. So that really, again, expanded my mind even further. So then as part of Reiki 3, some of the crystal work is, you know, what I was introduced to and what I'm just naturally gravitating towards.
Okay. So you have this altar at work, but I feel like Reiki would be like easily sort of applied to counseling to some extent, given that it is sort of a healing art. Do you ever incorporate these sorts of spiritual practices into your professional life?
I do. You know, and again, it's at the client's comfort level. You know, some people are very afraid of it. Some people are not ready to receive it. So, you know, I go based on their comfort level. And for me, it's very helpful to integrate it with clients, just learning about their own folklore and learning about their own family culture and histories, stories. And you know, as I learn more about them, then I'm able to introduce the ideas to them and see, you know, if they're open to it. But Reiki is a wonderful, just natural integration into counseling.
That's wonderful. I'm curious also about, so you say your mother had precognitions as you were growing up,
mm-hmm.
and this was part of, okay. So do you find yourself experiencing those same phenomena? Like, are you following in her footsteps in that way at all?
I think I'm intuitive with people. I do have some, I think I've had maybe one or two precognitive dreams, that I can really remember. My mom had, you know, she had dreamt about an earthquake that happened in Mexico in the 80s. You know, she had woken up screaming one morning and saying, you know, talking about an earthquake and how she needed to leave. And then, you know, an hour later, I remember turning on the TV and seeing that there, in fact, had been an earthquake in Mexico. So, you know, so she was that type of, you know, I don't think I haven't had anything like that where I could, you know, sense a massive event before it happened.
Okay. But you still are basing this novel partially on things you sort of saw in dreams or came to you in dreams, you were saying.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it was like lucid dreaming or like a part of it was, you know, I'd wake up and have this story in my mind and have to get up and write, you know, write for an hour. And then sometimes it would come to me, you know, doing mundane tasks.
Okay. Do you often incorporate this sort of experience into your writing process as a writer?
I think I do. I try to, you know, as soon as I have that feeling of, you know, I have the story building up or like, you know, I'm seeing kind of scenes, you know, I just stop what I'm doing and just start writing.
I mean, that's fantastic. I think more writers should be like that, honestly. Do you ever incorporate sort of spiritual practices into your writing? Like, do altar work in support of your creative process or maybe do something with pendulums or crystals to sort of open up those channels?
I haven't. Interestingly enough, I have not. And I think as I'm beginning to learn more about crystals, I think it's something that I will integrate. But, you know, part of my Reiki training, you know, my teacher did tell me that, you know, now that you've been attuned, you're going to see that opportunities, that things will just come to you to gravitate towards you. And, you know, things that you hadn't really looked at before, you'll start to notice more, and kind of that attunement to everything around me. And yeah, I've noticed that. So, you know, I think that it will help me naturally with my writing, and I'll figure out how to use the crystals to open up that chakra to get me more information.
Fantastic. So this novel is the first in a series, I'm led to understand.
Yes.
How, I feel like this is the sort of question that writers hate or might actually like, but how close are we to the next book in the series? What is it? Is it close at hand?
I'm working on book two right now. I'm getting it, starting the editing process of book two, and I have a lot of book three, pretty much ready to go. You know, I haven't looked at the final book in that, I think, in about 2 years. So I'm curious to see kind of what's in that folder, what I've been hiding there. But yeah, book two is rolling right along, and you know, I'm focusing on also getting some short essays out, and a couple children's books as well.
That's super cool. I don't want to, like, I don't, what's the phrase with the cat out of the bag? I don't want to let the cat out of the bag or anything like that, but like with these children's books, would you be willing to give us a sense of what those might be about? Because children's books are fantastic, and I'm a huge, huge fan of them. So I'm just, sorry, this is less me being a professional right now and just being super excited as a fanboy a little bit.
Yeah, I write about diversity. I try to integrate as much diversity as I can, and I'm writing about how to help children ask more questions and to feel safe about asking questions and talk about, you know, things that they're noticing around them and people and, you know, to just open themselves up a little bit more.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's, oh man. Okay, cool. I'm optimistic for the future because of things like this. Anyway, sorry, I'm getting distracted by how great children's books are.
I know they're wonderful. You know, when my children were younger, you know, when I'd go to bookstores, now there's a lot more diversity. But back then it was lacking. So, I really wanted to continue to write and to add things so that, you know, my daughters can relate and feel themselves in stories. So that was my main motivator.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Representation is super important. And, actually speaking of your children, are you sort of bringing them into these spiritual practices as well? Back to the central topic of the show. Are you in the same way that your mother had, or are you like, how's that? Well, how old are they? I guess is a more pertinent opening question for that.
Yeah, I have an 11 and a 9-year-old, and my oldest daughter is a lot like me. She's very scared of, you know, anything paranormal or strange. You know, she doesn't really want to know about it, but I know she senses it, and she has a really good sense about people and intuition. Like, you know, she'll say, I know that's not going to happen, or I she said she'd call, but I know she's not gonna, you know, like she has already that feeling. So I'll gently introduce her to it. You know, she doesn't like Day of the Dead. She doesn't want to know anything about, you know, relatives visiting the house or altars or anything like that. So it scares her still.
Okay. I mean, that's fair. I mean, I'm approaching 30 and I'm still kind of afraid of ghosts a lot. And paranormal stuff. Apparently. So I work at a witchcraft shop here in Brooklyn, and we just got haunted. Again or more. There's always been a ghost in the basement, but like there's a new one because somebody donated their private library of like grimoires and stuff like that, and apparently a ghost came with them.
Wow.
And
oh wow.
I keep closing up the shop and being terrified.
I'll clean it out for you guys.
Well, we tried with like lemongrass on the door frames, but I guess that didn't take. I keep closing the shop down, and I'm like constantly looking over, like actually trying not to look over my shoulder so I don't see anything, because I feel like I would sprint out of the building without locking up, and that's just irresponsible, and that's wrong.
Right. Well, I'll give you a quick suggestion, and you can kind of think about it.
Thank you.
So one thing that might be helpful is to clean, I think the lemongrass was a good start, but, you know, on your way to work or wherever you are, to collect long branches, like greens, leaves, lots of leaves. Collect a good handful of them, say a prayer or whatever spirituality that you connect with, and have the intention of cleaning, offering whatever's in there to leave, to have peace. And you just go through the entire store, you know, with the leaves, all the corners, you know, sweeping and brushing out all that negative energy to get it out. And then the leaves, after you're done cleaning, you know, dispose of them far away.
Right. Okay, thank you. That's really helpful. I appreciate that. Gosh. This, once again, I've turned what is supposed to be a public interview into a personally helpful thing just for me. You mentioned that you've been exploring pendulum work. Could you go into that a little bit? Because I feel like a lot of people are not terribly familiar with that particular area of practice.
Right. Well, as I'm learning, you know, I picked out, it's important to pick out a pendulum that you feel connected to. So when you're looking at them, you know, just see there's so many different variations to pendulums. So it's important to really, when you're shopping for one, to take your time to really feel them out and see what you connect with. For me, I'm just starting with the pendulum work. So when I first started to hold it, nothing would happen. And I was like, well, what's going on here? But the longer that I held it and the more that I kind of just connected to it, you know, you just ask yes or no questions and see, you know, the first question you ask is show me yes, show me no, and see how your pendulum begins to move and connect with you. And it takes a little bit of time, you know, you're forming a relationship there. And then, you know, you can use it to see if chakras are blocked. You can ask questions, should I go to work today? You know, fun stuff like that in time.
Okay, cool. And
but yeah, that's just very, you know, I'm new to it too, so that's how I've been using it.
Okay, well, I mean, that's a great thing just to point out for everybody else that, it, you know, always keep trying, always try the new things, even when you feel very established as a practitioner of various magical rites. Like, there's always step one for everything, so.
Yes. And, you know, don't overlook that first step, because that's really where you're grounding yourself and forming that connection.
That's fantastic.
People are quick to just want it to work quickly and then to, you know, but it takes time to cultivate that.
Right. I mean,
that energy.
I mean, you mentioned that when you were doing Reiki, like, you're still in a way cultivating your awareness of the magical forces of the universe's spiritual forces therein.
Absolutely.
Great. Let's see here. We've talked about tradition. We've talked about. So I don't want to like.
I had a quick question for you.
Ooh, exciting!
Yes. So I had heard on a previous podcast that you were talking about Lana Del Rey being a practitioner as well. Is that right?
Yeah. So she has been in the news a lot recently for doing a lot of witchcraft. Notably, she's been trying to hex Donald Trump, which, I mean, who hasn't? But it's interesting because I feel like recently a lot of, you know, you had that span in the 70s or so where a lot of fairly popular musicians were getting involved in witchcraft and occult practices. You know, David Bowie was convinced that Robert Plant might be trying to use magic to destroy him, and so Robert Plant, to assuage David Bowie's concerns, sent David Bowie a jar full of his toenail clippings as sort of like magical insurance to be used against him.
Yes.
And you had sort of stuff like that, but like I feel like we're coming back to a time like that, because you had you had Lana Del Rey. There's that fellow Matt Skiba from the Alkaline Trio who says that he thinks he used his pagan background to sabotage the fire festival.
Oh, wow.
And I mean,
that's amazing.
It's kind of great, though. I mean, it's hard to, because I mean, a lot of people are coming up publicly and saying, like, I'm doing this, this is who I am. Though I feel like there's also a fair amount of conspiracy theory kind of stuff going around where people are convinced mm-hmm. that musicians are being very successful because of this sort of thing. I think there's a lot floating around that Jay-Z is secretly using dark magic. I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah, these are great. But these are great times to be alive and to be interested in these sorts of things. When you go looking for information on practices that you're interested in, like pendulums or Reiki, where do you go for that information? Are you consulting? Do you mostly just talk to people who are already doing it, or do you like go on the internet? Like, what are your sources?
For Reiki, it was pretty easy to just look for a teacher or someone who was teaching locally in my area and someone who was certified at, higher levels in their Reiki training. But I had registered for Reiki classes, a year ago, 2 years ago, even trying to get the right fit. And it never would happen. Something would get in the way, scheduling conflicts, money, all kinds of problems would happen. And then finally, a few weeks ago, was where I had found the class all of a sudden in the weirdest place. And the teacher and I connected in a really great way. And it was just she and I. The other students who were supposed to take the class didn't make it. So I think it was just meant to be that we were meant to connect. And she really offered me a lot more of her time, a lot more of her her knowledge. So I guess it happens when it's meant to.
I mean, that's really great. I mean, like, that openness, I think, is also really important. Just sort of look for your moments when the universe is sort of saying, do this, not that. And
Right. Letting
that push you forward. Great. Well, I've been holding you on the line for quite some time now, so I don't want to take up too much more of your time. But if... you like having this platform for people who are interested in these sorts of topics and are interested in spirituality, ritual, magic, things like that. If you had to give them sort of a chunk of advice, like a sort of golden nugget of wisdom, or like just sort of a warning, or like anything that you like would want to say to people at large involved in these sorts of things, what would that be?
Stay hopeful. My favorite quote is to dwell in possibility. I always tell people that I live in that space of just, anything's possible, to stay very curious and, definitely that hopefulness, I think is an important message because we're living in difficult times and, it's easy to get frustrated and it's easy to get discouraged, just turning on your TV. So that message of hopefulness, of bringing things back to basics, focusing on, especially in the Wiccan and the pagan traditions and, focusing on your folklore, your customs, getting back to your roots is so important.
That's fantastic. And if people want to learn more about you, your writing, the work you're doing, where are some good places for them to go to?
Oh, if you could follow me on, check me out on Facebook or Twitter. I try not to post too much, so but I do post a lot of pictures of my poodle, so I apologize in advance.
That sounds like a bonus to me, honestly.
So definitely Facebook or Twitter is probably the best way to reach me. And I try to answer all the emails, definitely. I love to connect with readers and just to hear, thoughts and what people are looking forward to for book two.
That's fantastic. And so everybody, please check out her novel, Santa Muerte, 2016, the first in the Daniela story, I think is the name of the larger series, right?
Yes, that's correct. And it's on Amazon. I'm just so grateful. I wrote the book hoping for 10 readers. That was my goal, and it's well surpassed that, and I'm just deeply grateful and really, really just happy just to connect with more people.
That's great. And congratulations on all the success you're having with this book. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me and with everybody who's listening.
Cooper, thank you so, so much. I'm so grateful for the time to talk with you. And it's just been a really great experience. Thank you again.
Thank you. Okay, cool. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
So many thanks to Lucina Stone for talking to us here on Into the Dark. And you know, it's interesting. A lot of the people we've had on this show recently, you know, they talk about getting involved in magic and spirituality and things like that. And it had to be their sort of journey on their own. Like, it was a thing they did instead of what their parents were doing, instead of what their families were doing. And it is really nice to hear someone talk about the idea of passing down these sorts of beliefs, these traditions, these ways of approaching the world through a family, in the way that it can sort of bring a family together. And honestly, if that's something you want to talk about, regardless of your, like, maybe your parents did this and you're still kind of not sure about it, or you reject it, but like it's an important part of your relationship with your parents, because we always hear from practitioners on this show, but I am curious to hear about, you know, the people who love people who do magic, the family members of people who do magic. So if you're interested in doing that sort of thing, please do contact us at intothedarkrfb@gmail.com, or contact me on Twitter at Cooper Wilhelm. I'd love to come. We can have a chat. We can call you on the phone in the studio, because I apparently know how to do that now. So that's really exciting for me. Also, a great reason to contact me / the show at those two places, intothedarkrfb@gmail.com, because you are listening to Radio Free Brooklyn right now, or that's what the RFB stand for, or on Twitter at Cooper Wilhelm. Speaking of which, we will post links to the social media presences of Lucina Stone when this becomes a podcast, so you can, you know, check her out, check out her work, which you should do. Absolutely. Definitely check out that novel. Check out the essay she did at Luna Luna. We'll post a link to that as well. Where was I? Right. Another thing you can do if you contact me / the show at these places is that you can submit listener questions about magic, about ritual. And so we have one today. And it's a bit complicated because the person who submitted this listener question, they were looking for a hex. And after asking for the hex, they sort of, like, I told them, like, hey, I'm doing this research. I'm figuring it out. And then they kind of backed off and said, like, they weren't as angry anymore. And I think in so much as that occurred, there is a lesson, which is that it is important when you're considering doing some kind of hex, some kind of binding spell, something kind of negative or aggressive, that, you know, it's worth considering, you know, maybe sleep on it. Like, you know, a lot of states make you do like a 24-hour or a 72-hour waiting period before you buy a handgun or something like that. You know, treat magic the same way. Because, I mean, there are some traditions that will tell you that every negative thing you do will come back to you threefold. And I kind of want that to be true, because I feel like people, like, bring up earlier, Donald Trump, if all the negative things he did came back to him threefold, there'd be nothing left but a smoldering pile of misery and cruelty in a crater. But clearly that hasn't happened yet. But at the same time, there are a lot of traditions that say that that's not true, that if you want to do hex work, curse work, that you do it. And it'll be done. But at the same time, be careful, be cautious, because for a lot of these things, there is the possibility that this stuff will stick. And actually, in trying to find curse work for my friend, who sort of submitted this question, this was a sort of personal submission. This was done directly to me at my phone, which I have, and I would give the number to, but I don't know who could be listening to this. It could be bad. But anyway, point is, they submitted this, and the first thing I found was actually permanent. It was a binding spell that would just sort of last forever. which is potentially more of a commitment than you might be after. Though, at the same time, there are ways to also make seemingly permanent spells more temporary. For example, with candlework, a thing you can do if you're doing magic with a candle is to essentially carve a date at which you want the spell to end into the bottom of the candle as a way of basically putting an expiration date on the ritual, which can be helpful not only in sort of limiting potentially the negative impact of the thing you are doing on the person you are doing it to, but also just giving yourself a good gauge of how effective what you're doing is. Like, if you say you want something by a certain date, you can basically say, you know, once you check at that date, did it work? Did it not work? Instead of just like constantly waiting for the magic to come. But anyway, so this Into the Dark listener question that we're fielding today is, dear Into the Dark, I was recently ghosted. Can you recommend a hex or a spell that will lead to that person being ghosted back? And so that's an interesting one, because in a lot of ways, being ghosted is kind of like a very, it can feel like a very contemporary spell. Like, the idea, like, conceivably you could be ghosted via a letter a long time ago, or ghosted via just like, you know, someone used to come up to the window and say, hey, and now they don't anymore, of your house. Like, I don't, you know, it, but at the same time, it, there's something very cell phone oriented about just like not getting texted back and how hard that can be on a person. And so there isn't a lot in the sort of traditional sources for people dealing with this particular kind of problem, looking for solutions to it. So we kind of have to like improvise with things that are fairly close to what we want, but maybe not exactly what we want. And a lot of those things come from the hoodoo or conjure traditions of magic. So we got two spells for you today to sort of do that to somebody, to sort of like make the ghoster be ghosted, but ghost the ghoster. You know, consider them if you're in this situation or not. But our first one involves the making of a mirror box. And the thing is, like, a mirror box is a great form of magic, because so much of like the magic you find out there today in the various sources of magic that people use, I don't know, zines, GeoCities websites, and so on, it's a primarily sort of verbal process. It's saying things at particular times, in particular ways, in particular places, and that's good and that's fine. But you know, there's so many parts of you as a human being that you might want to express, and one of them is sort of, could be crafts. And honestly, this spell feels like a crafts kind of thing. So what you first want to do for this spell, this mirror spell, I mean, the source I'm working with suggests that you get a reading first, just to see how you're doing. And like, if you're like, I think like the idea being sort of, are you spiritually healthy enough for curse work? Which is kind of like when pharmaceutical ads, let's say, like, you know, if you're interested in Viagra, are you physically healthy enough for sex? But like, are you spiritually strong enough to do this kind of stuff? But once you've done that, the thing to do is to buy a mirror. And the thing about this mirror, so this is where things get a bit tricky, because the mirror that you use for a mirror box can never have held your reflection. It has to be one that you've never been in, or else this curse might affect you. So I don't know how you buy mirrors to avoid being in them. I would suggest approaching a mirror from behind. But once you do that, you should take this mirror that you have purchased and then smash it with a hammer, or really any sort of blunt object. I mean, a hammer is good. And while doing that, you know, state loudly your intention that the bad luck of breaking the mirror is going to go to your enemy to whom you are directing the curse, not to you. This is not actually the crux of the curse. It's just, you know, safety first. And then what you need to do is glue all the pieces of this broken mirror into a chipboard box without your reflection appearing in any of those pieces. This is, I think, the hard, like, this is conceivably even more difficult than buying a mirror without appearing in it, smashing a mirror and gluing it without appearing in it, but people have done it. It can be done. So then what you need to do is make a doll baby. This is a technical term, of the person you are trying to curse. And so what you're going to do is take a fabric dolly that you have made out of black flannel. And it has to be small enough to fit in the box. And stuff it with Spanish moss so you can cross your enemy with misfortune, ill health, and misery. And you are to place what is referred to as a personal concern of the enemy within this doll. And once you've done that, put the doll... Oh, I'm sorry. I've missed some steps in preparing this doll. Haha, silly me. I'm rushing too fast. So then what you need to do is... So blindfold the doll as a way of protecting your identity from being discovered once you have done this curse. And then with a bit of whiskey, baptize the doll and name it after your enemy. Like, you're trying to basically create an enemy surrogate out of this doll. And say to it some sort of statement of intention, not unlike, "You are no longer cloth and herbs. You are now flesh and blood. And I hold your fate and well-being in my hands." And then you need to punish the doll. Now, this is where sort of using pins in a doll can come in handy. But in terms of this sort of idea of like trying to get a ghost or ghosted, trying to thwart someone who has ghosted you in a romantic situation from having successful romantic situations post that, is you could tie it up, because binding the doll symbolically prevents this, the object of your curse, from being able to act further. So you can also afflict the target of the curse with powders placed upon the doll. And some of these are symbolic. Some of these, I think, are more sort of trying to sort of transmit an actual physical effect. So I think, like, if you did, like, itching powder, that could conceivably have an effect on your curse. But, like, some of these are also symbolic. So, like, gunpowder could be sprinkled upon the doll to explosively reflect their evil deeds back at them. Crab shell powder could be used to reverse any magic you think they're doing towards you back towards them, or any and you know, blackberry leaf can be used to trip an enemy. But really, the point of the mirror box really is to do onto them what they have done onto you or done onto others, which is why the sort of ghosting thing, it feels applicable, right? Because if they've ghosted you, you can get them ghosted. And then finally, I take that back, this isn't final there. So then you're supposed to do a funeral rite for the object of your curse. So close the lid of the box as though it were a coffin, and you can decorate it to look at make it look more like a coffin, and then do a mock funeral ceremony for this doll, which represents the person who is the object of your curse. Okay, so now you need a reversing candle. And a reversing candle is essentially a candle where you have a candle that's red on the inside and black on the outside. But that's, of course, so I'm sorry. So you need a reversing candle that is red on the inside, black on the outside. And the way you make it a reversing candle is that you take a standard candle, so like a thick kind of taper candle, you cut the tip off of it so that now the top part where the wick is flat. Then you flip it upside down and you carve a new tip where the bottom had been for the wick. And this is a way of symbolically making this candle such that it will reverse anything that is directed towards you back at its origin. Again, we are talking about ghosting. And now carve the name of your target, the object of your curse, backwards so that it will appear correctly in the mirror fragments in the box into the candle. and also carve into it all your evil returns to you 10x or 10 times tenfold, and set that candle above the mirror box and put all of this, the box, the candle, on a mirror covered with more crab shell powder, and burn that reversing candle you have made all the way to its bottom. And then take the box, the candle drippings, and any of the powder that's left to a graveyard and bury it. And once you've done that, we come now to the final primary step of this, which is selling your enemy to the souls of the dead. So take a bottle of whiskey, a silver dime, a garden trowel, a black candle, a lighter, and this sort of mirror box, candle, mirror sort of stage you have set up, and take them all to the graveyard. And in the middle of the cemetery, and say your name, and then say loudly now in the cemetery with these things, which of you is willing to work for me? Who is willing to take this wretched evil person out of this world for the sins they have committed? Who is willing to do this work in exchange for whiskey and a silver dime? And then listen in your mind for the spirits, and let them guide you to the grave that is calling for this, that is willing to do this work on your behalf. Then dig a hole in the ground and place the mirror box coffin inside, along with the candle wax that is melted down from this reversing candle. And then say, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, I turn your body and soul over to the spirit of this grave and take you out of this world for your wicked ways, once and for all. Amen. And then stand over the grave and perform a mock burial, saying, and go, like, you know, sell it. Because we're doing this for ritual purposes, so we're gonna, like, it's not enough just to say the words. You gotta feel it, you gotta make it work. So sell it and say, we are gathered here today to mourn the passing of, name of the person you are cursing, from this world and into the next. They were taken by the righteous hand of God out of this world for the evil sins they committed. They suffered death as a result of their own curses toward an innocent person, and their soul rots in hell forever. So, you know, angry funeral. And then put the silver dime in the hole, cover it with earth, and then replace the sod, and finish by pouring a bottle of whiskey over the grave in payment to the spirit that has made this sort of spiritual contract with you. And then place and light a black candle at the headstone of the grave to offer the spirit light for its insistence and its working. And then walk away from the grave and do not look back. And head home, do an uncrossing bath, cleanse yourself, cleanse your altar, and dress in white for the rest of the day. And then you've got yourself a reverse curse using a mirror box. So, you know, that's thing about curse work. Sometimes it can be very easy, sometimes it can be very intuitive. For example, when Leza Cantoral came on the show a few weeks back to talk about hexing people, I mean, she didn't realize she was doing it. Like, she just was so in tune, and her emotional energy was so strong that she just sort of accidentally just put curses on people, broke their bones. But you can also do something like this, where you can really make it happen. You can commit to it, you can own it. And I honestly think that's better, because, you know, it's very easy to get angry and do something you might regret later, in the heat of the moment. And whereas that sort of emotional energy of being that angry, being that upset, and really having the intention and the commitment within you to want to harm someone could actually be good sort of energy and fuel for this kind of rite. You know, it's good to be sure, I would say. You know, treat it like a gun. never point it at anybody unless you're willing to hurt them. And, you know, take advantage of that 3-day waiting period before you get to buy one. So I've got another spell here that it's a chilling spell. This is also from the hoodoo and conjuring sort of tradition. And I don't know if we have enough time to really talk about it, but it is fun. As much as curse work can be fun. So I am going to do a link to it so you can read up on it. Maybe try it at home. I mean, don't be flippant about this. I mean, it is curse work. Like, you know, like some of these things can be kind of fun to do and try out. Like if you're trying to like, you know, increase your sexual potency or do something like one of the sort of fun spells that are out there. But this is kind of dark and heavy stuff. So like, don't do it unless you mean it. But basically the idea of this is that you, would take an animal tongue, like a cow's tongue, to symbolize speech. Or you would take a large whole sour pickle and haul it out to symbolize a man's sexual fertility. Or a sliced fig to symbolize a woman's sexual potency and fertility. Or a lemon. Or wetted underwear. This is, again, sexual. The lemon is for just general souring of the life, but the wetted underwear refers to sexual energy. But you would take one of those, and in that you would place the name or names of the people you're trying to freeze, the people you're trying to stop in their tracks. And you would put that in this vessel you have made. So the tongue for speaking, the pickle or fig or wetted underwear for sexual activities, the lemon for just their general life. And then you would pray over it and add herbs that are appropriate from a magical context to the thing you're trying to do and the thing you're trying to sort of punish. So like, for example, red pepper can be used to make lies burn in people's mouths. Alum can be used to silence speech. Poppy seeds can be used to confuse people or make them lose paperwork or miss appointments. Like this freezing spell that I'm talking about, that like this sort of hoodoo one, is often used, I think, or can be used in terms of like thwarting, instead of like, I mean, we're talking about in the context of ghosting, right? But like this could be used to thwart people who are pursuing legal action against you, which it's a consideration. So but this is only sort of the beginning of it. I mean, it involves like, the rest of it involves like sewing or pitting wetted paper to this either animal tongue or pickle or what have you, and putting it in the freezer. And like, there's a lot more here steps wise. So like, I'll post a link to that. If anybody wants me to go over this another episode, we can do that. And actually, if you have any questions about magic that you want addressed on this show, please do send them to intothedarkrfb@gmail.com, because you're listening to Into the Dark on Radio Free Brooklyn, or just get at me on Twitter at Cooper Wilhelm, Cooper like the tire, Wilhelm like the Kaiser. We've got one I'm still researching, and I feel bad about that, but someone did ask a very good question about the relationship between mental health and magic, and I'm doing a lot of research right now into that. So like, I think whatever episode we have 2 weeks from now should be the one where I'm able to address that in full. But it's a complicated topic, and it's an exciting topic. It's worth listening out to. So keep listening to this show, keep listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, and don't be shy, guys. If you are curious about literally anything, it's a wide world of magic, and it's just waiting for you to be a part of it. So if there's something you want to know about, contact us here, and we'll be happy to help you out. Keep listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, and have a good night.